Hello, everyone. I'm Corey.
I'm Kate.
And I'm Alec.
And this is the Utini Avatar Show, proud partner of the Utini Network, where we are discussing Avatar, The Last Airbender, the new live-action show on Netflix. Now, this week, we are talking all about episode 4 of the show. We're going to be taking a look at the dynamics of the Fire Nation royal family, the depth of Iroh and Zuko's relationship, and the playful yet kind of different inclusion of the secret tunnel and all things that are happening with the Earth Kingdom this episode. So thanks for hanging out with us. Be sure to leave us a review wherever you get your podcast if you like what you hear. Now, before we get into this week's conversation, we have to thank our sponsor, the United Patreon Community. Head over to patreon.com/utini to see everything that our community has to offer. Now, stay tuned for more details about that later in the show. All right, guys, welcome. Thanks for hanging out with me on this lovely Sunday morning. This is going to be a fun conversation to talk about episode 4. We're also going to bank the next episode right after this recording, I think, as well. So it'll be fun to kind of hit two episodes in one recording session here. And this one was fun. We got to, we both watched this. It's here, Alec, you told us before we started recording here that you watched this episode like 3 times, right? You watched it 3 times?
Yeah, I have a process for how I do these things now. So
it
involves watching it 3 times. I'm not mad about it. If the show was bad, I would feel bad. But actually, I'm really enjoying the show. So watching it 3 times has not been a headache.
Yeah, 100%. Caitlin and I also watched it
twice.
We watched it twice, which is the second time. And I think it's a general rule of TV shows. It seems like, at least for me personally, that like if I watch a show more than once, I almost like it better the second time around every single time. That's almost the case for movies and TV and everything.
Because you get the shock value out.
I guess so. And a show like this that is an adaptation of the animated series, like, you know, you already have like a story in the back of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess it's good to... You get used to it. You get used to the change, I suppose. So, let's just dive right in. We're also short a man today. Eric was not able to join us for this recording, but we will carry on with his soul on our backs. Just made that up. Let's start the show by talking about some of how the show opened. The show opened with Aang and Iroh in jail together. There was a couple of really interesting moments in there. One of the things that really stood out to me is Iroh talked about, how Earth Kingdom cities, they don't have seams. That was an interesting comment, I thought.
Yeah, which he's very, very intimate with, as we find out later in the episode.
That's right.
During his siege of Ba Sing Se.
Yes. That was kind of where I was going with that, is that, like, he seems like only someone who tried to... kind of break down the walls would notice something like that, right?
Yeah.
But that was a cool little comment. And, you know, we opened this episode with Iroh and Aang kind of talking about Zuko, right? And there was a bit of a disagreement between the two of them. Aang essentially says that, you know, where's Zuko? He sucks. And Iroh is like, well, maybe you don't know him that well. And we use that sort of as a transition to kind of talk about some royal family dynamics. So what'd you guys think about that? That sort of opening with Iroh and Aang? Because we're getting a lot of Iroh and Aang sort of interacting in this show, which is different, I think, than the animated show. Alec?
Yeah, it's definitely different. I think the scene works really well. The only thing I was a little, you know, when you talk about the exposition and how they do it in the scene, Iroh walking away and being like the pit that no one comes back from.
Yeah, that was funny.
You know, it felt very much like that Pirates of the Caribbean scene where it's like, well, if no one comes back from, then how do you know where do the stories come
exactly.
from? you know, but yeah, the scene works really well. I mean, you see the child nature of Aang and kind of his thought process of, you know, well, you're his uncle. You just, you know, he owes you. You just tell him what to do. You know, and Aang has no idea the complexity of the relationship between Iroh and Zuko. So I'm really, really happy with the episode and we fleshed that out. But for this scene in particular, I think Iroh, you know, I know we kind of harped on some of the acting and, you know, the character. But I think we are finally breaking those barriers. We're breaking those walls. We're getting to see a side of Iroh and this actor and how he's taking on that role. And I think we're all kind of coming around, at this point. So getting to see that opening scene between them and how it sets up, you know, for the rest of the episode and the character changes that we see with Zuko is really nice.
Yeah. Go ahead, Caitlin.
I like it a lot. It is reminiscence of like Iroh and Toph for me in the animated show because they interact several different times. And it seems like this. It feels like this. Of like, well, you're his uncle. He should listen to you.
Yeah. That is a great throwback. We are seeing a little bit of that relationship with Aang, which is kind of an interesting change. I don't hate it.
No, I like it.
I think it's kind of interesting. Getting to see Iroh with Aang kind of right out the gate is pretty interesting. And I think let's use this as sort of a transition to talk about, you know, the next place we went with this scene, which is, you know, what that transition was supposed to be for in the first place, is to kind of flash back to, I think, one of the most meaningful, dramatic, emotional moments that we've had in this entire show so far, which is we flash back to Lu Tin's funeral, right? And I would argue that, man, this entire scene was just one of the richest scenes we've seen so far. But what was your kind of gut reaction to, I don't know, getting this, you know, the leaves on the vine in the background? Man, it was just hard-hitting.
Like, yeah, and it still hit just as hard. You know, I mean, I was still tearing up.
Yeah, 100%.
I think I cried like twice during that scene. It was just so emotional and rich.
The funeral scene, I think in particular, really showcased this sort of vulnerability of Iroh. And I would say that this is a pretty big difference, I think, from the TV show. You know, we got that one very short story that hit us all very hard. I think it's one of the reasons that the leaves from the vine kind of hit you so hard in your soul, because we all remember how emotional and wonderful that was from the animated show. But we're getting this sort of depth to Iroh by, you know, this is not the first time we've brought up Lu Tin, I don't think. This is the second or third time I think we've brought him up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very interesting to sort of see this difference from the animated show. What do you think the sort of choice to use leaves from the vine subtly in the background? What do you think about that choice to kind of add to the emotional weight of this scene, Alec?
Yeah, my wife's a music teacher. We were kind of talking about it, and I was trying to figure out what the instruments were and like what was being used, and getting that orchestral background. And I mean, we get it multiple times throughout this episode. I think if I wrote this down correctly, I believe the instrument is called a koto. It's a Japanese instrument that kind of looks like a curved guitar neck, spread out. I can't remember how many strings, like 10, 12, something like that. But it's a beautiful sounding instrument. It's very, very traditional. I'm not sure how old it is, but I'm sure it's very old. And it's beautiful. And we get to have that with kind of a more orchestral kind of sound behind it during parts of the episode. And then sometimes it's just the Kyoto. It's not, or the Koto. It's just, you know, I think if they didn't include it, we would be harping about, you know, why didn't we get to hear that? You know, there's something about that. I feel like if I was just going about my daily life, and it doesn't matter what I'm doing, and somebody started playing Leaves of the Fine, I would stop everything.
Hey, seriously.
Yeah. Start crying.
It is one of those songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think that is, actually? I think that's an interesting thought, because, you know, doing some of the research for the show and kind of reading about it online, it seems like this song's inclusion kind of hit a lot of people really hard. And what do you think that is? Because
it's got to be the original storytelling.
You think that's really it? I mean, it was only that one little episode.
I mean, I think music in general, you know, and I personally feel very, very in tune with music. It literally can change my mood very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, music itself is something that, you know, there's a science behind it too, right? Like, you know, DJs, you know, try to control the BPM of the, you know, of the crowd. And it's so something like this, it's very slow and very, you know, low, and just kind of like has this steadiness to it. It slows you down. And it kind of slows down your thought process, and it brings you into more of a reflective kind of feeling and mood than I think, you know, that you may even realize at the time. So, you know, a song like this becomes very, very powerful. And especially if you have any memories with a song, of course, then that immediately gets brought back.
That's what I was going to bring up, is that I think everyone that is affected by this song probably watched that original episode. And like, just like with Alzheimer's patients, we use music therapy all the time. And it brings back memories that we just can't access anymore. And so the like heavy tie between emotions and music and memory is just so strong that I don't think it's like bringing in a delicious like roast chicken. You're just going to start salivating immediately. Like this is just the emotional salivation that's happening.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, this I can specifically remember, you know, back in the old days, I used to watch, I don't know, I think I brought this up. Speaking of unlocking memories, Ken, unlocking a poor memory here. Back in the old days, I had an iPod Classic, like, you know, the big classic with like the, it was like a two and a half inch
yeah, what was it like?
Screen.
Mm-hmm.
Weighed like 100 pounds, you know.
Yeah, it did music in megabytes, not in gigabytes.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. I had the first edition of the iPod Classic. It had the color screen. If you remember, the box had like, it had Captain Jack Sparrow in the box. That was like part of the marketing. I don't know if you guys remember that.
No, I do not.
Yeah, it was, I can see it. It was Captain Jack Sparrow. It was lots of blue. Anyway, that was the whole marketing was like, look, you can watch Pirates of the Caribbean on an iPod. It was really funny. But anyway, I was in my peak DVD ripping era when I had that iPod Classic. And Avatar was one of the shows that I used to record on TV. And I got to where I became a master of that, right? So like, you're watching it and I would pause it right as it went to commercial, and then I would unpause it. Like, so like I would edit it basically as I was watching it. So I would get commercial free episodes basically to put on the iPod. And then I would use the software to put it on the iPod, all this thing. And I remember I used to watch this, I used to watch the show all the time on this goofy little iPod Classic. And I have a very vivid memory of watching this one episode over and over again. The sort of short story episode, because it's really good. Almost every single little short story that is in that animated episode is fantastic. And man, they used to hit me so hard. It was the last story, wasn't it? Was it the last story?
I think it was like the second to last story.
Second to last story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was towards the end of the episode.
It was just so rich. I mean, you know, Iroh lit the incense and he was underneath the tree and it's really beautiful storytelling. So I think that you're probably right. And maybe it is some kind of deep emotional psychology here.
Well, I think too, isn't that song was sung by the voice actor who passed away, right? Like one of his last, you know, couple things that he did with the show before he passed.
Yeah. So I think reading about it, like they dedicated the episode to him in the animated show.
Yeah, but if memory serves me, he didn't want to do it, but they asked him to, and eventually he kind of caved and said, "Okay, mm-hmm. okay, I'll do it." So you know, I know for the people that were involved in the original animated series, that song has even a deeper meaning than just the show context. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm sure for a lot of the fandom, it does as well.
God, you're gonna make me cry right now.
I know, seriously. Well, so, outside of the really rich emotional storytelling we got in that scene, we also got a pretty interesting look at some Fire Nation royalty family dynamics here, which
absolutely.
Is pretty interesting. And I want to talk about Lutin and how this entire funeral was sort of depicted a little bit, because this was all very different from the animated show, and we got kind of a deeper understanding of like what it's like to be a kid in the Fire Nation a little bit, because... Yeah, there were several things that kind of stood out to me in this scene. And one of those is this sort of theme of pride and propaganda, I guess, a little bit. Because the things that everybody says, you know, when the scene opens, that people are walking away and they're saying he gave up after, you know, he gave up his siege after his son died.
His son's a hero. He's a coward.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Ozai said as well to Iroh. That's what Zuko said initially at first, too. It was like, you know, it's a great honor.
They said your son had a great honor.
Well, and Zuko says, "What a great honor for you and your son to die."
Yeah,
and I was like, "Oh gosh, did he mean it? Like Iroh is also like dead. Yeah. He's just like a husk of himself." I'm sure it's not meant that way, but the wording of it was very like the third time watching it, when I heard it again, I'm like, man, it's like every time I hear it, it strikes me as like. They're just like saying that Iroh is also just like he died internally when his son died, which is basically what happened.
I mean, that usually is what happens to parents when a child dies.
Yeah.
They almost, this is a fun psychology fact, but most couples don't stay together after a child dies.
Yeah.
They will get divorced because the pain is so immense.
Yeah. Caitlin is a therapist for our listeners that may not have known that. So it's one of the reasons we sort of want to talk about that and bring that up a little bit. I want to ask you guys, what do you think about how does this inclusion of this type of stuff about the Fire Nation, like sort of themes and about culture and propaganda, how does this stuff sort of add to the development of the Fire Nation? Because that is different from the anime.
I just had a thought on this while y'all were talking. Because we see Zuko and he's saying the things that are expected of him, like what a great honor it is. And I just like it clicked in my head. And then we see him hesitate and then say something actually real of like, this is like Luten meant a lot to me, even outside of his death, not just because he died serving our country. Like, he was a good guy. And you should be proud of that. You raised a good guy. Like, he said something meaningful.
It was.
And it struck me because that's just showing Zuko's character. And I realized Azula would never do that.
Right.
Azula is
she wasn't even in the scene, right?
Rules. No, she wasn't.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that one thing the show is really getting right is its development of Zuko and Iroh and the Fire Nation.
Family dynamics.
And
Do you think Zuko being there and not Azula, is that a sign that the Fire Lord is like prepping Zuko, or like he's more focused on Zuko being his heir instead of Azula?
Possibly.
That's a good question.
How old was Zuko when this happened? Like,
well, I don't know. The timeline is a little funny.
I know, it's a little funky.
Yeah,
we talked about that. That is different from the animated show. The timeline seems to be a little different because it sort of implied that it was a long time ago when Luten died in the animated show. Mm-hmm. But Iroh and Zuko look the same age, and it looks like it was like 2 months ago. Like that's a good point.
It's, I mean, we can probably safely assume it's been a couple years, but that's about it.
One of my favorite comments I saw online is, somebody said that the funeral scene had them tear bending. One of the other things I heard when I was doing some digging too is that we, in the entire animated show, we never got a single scene between Iroh and Ozai. Not a single time. They never met. They never talked. We never saw them at all in the animated show. So this was different that we got to see this. And I'm a big fan of Ozai and the way they're depicting the Fire Nation.
Yeah. I think that's one thing. So, like, you know, obviously, Corey, you know more about Star Wars than I will ever know in my entire life. But I think I can safely assume that the Empire is, like, they don't do anything in Star Wars, really, in the main, you know, movies, not necessarily some of the subplots that you get to get into, which are endless, but... you know, they don't kind of get into this, like, oh, there's a human side really to a lot of these characters, you know, but with a show like Avatar, they're, you know, especially with this live action show, we're very quickly diving into, like, this is very complex, you know, like this country has been at war so long that the majority of people that are still alive have no idea why it even started, you know, or if they do know why it started, they're being taught. So, like in the animated show, when Aang and Sokka and Katara are in the Fire Nation, like they go to school. I don't know if you remember that. But like they're literally in school, and Aang's like learning about the, you know, they're like teaching about how the war started, and it's like, oh, you know, the Airbenders, you know, fought with their army, and Aang's like, the Air Nation doesn't have an army. Like, what are you talking about? So, you know, the idea that we have this this enemy that's all evil, that there's no redeemable qualities at all, and they're basically just robots, you know, bent on destruction. You know, is something that's very, very easy to get into when you're getting into media, but with this show on the Fire Nation, you know, there's very human elements, and this scene, you know, encapsulates all of that. Of like, you know, they are you know, we are crying about uncle who lost his son, and they're the ones that are invading, and they're the ones that are sieging a city and causing people to, you know, die of famine and, you know, starvation, and people to, you know, kill each other over scraps of food. So, like, you know, but we're crying about this scene. Yeah, so, right. You know, they do such a wonderful job in the show, both the animated and the live action. And honestly, I think the live action for me is telling the story and in a way that, you know, it's a little more concise, of course, you know, because they have to do it that way. But there are certain things that they've changed that I really, really like. And you know, in my time of kind of rewatching the show and listening to some of the producers and writers, and, you know, I know that the two guys involved in the animated show walked away from the live action, but, you know, even they have said multiple times, like, well, of course there are things that we would change. You know, there were decisions that were made that when we finished the episode and, you know, released it, like, we immediately thought, oh gosh, we should have done this other thing. So,
yeah,
you know, the idea that the Avatar: The Last Airbender, the animated show, is perfect, I think is something that is just, you know, when we look back on stuff, you know, in our lives, it's always, you know, rosier.
Yeah, and rose-colored glasses a little bit.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah.
So, 100% agree. I mean,
so these changes are good to me.
I agree. Yeah. You know, I think that this being a sort of storytelling device to talk about Iroh and Zuko's relationship, which was obviously developed over three seasons of a show, an animated show. I mean, we're starting out really, really rich. And I guess the last thing that I want to say about Iroh and Zuko is, you know, the way that the rest of this episode sort of transitioned with, you know, Iroh coming to the boat, says everything I need is on this boat. That was such a great line. And then the very end of the episode where, you know, the Avatar's in the sky, right? And they're in the canoe and they fly.
You noticed this the second time we watched it.
Yeah, the perfect transition between those two scenes is Iroh says everything I need is on this boat. They have a moment together. The next scene we see is immediately both of them on a boat. And Zuko looks up into the sky and the Avatar flies over and Iroh's like, what is it? And he says, nothing. And that's Zuko saying, everything that I need is on this boat. And that was beautiful.
Yeah. It was.
That was beautiful. That was really good story.
Giving me chills right now.
And that was like, that was after Iroh's line of, that's our lot in life, always getting on and off boats.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful. Well, let's transition and talk a little more about some of the other major themes of this show. I'm sorry we got so hung up on Iroh and Zuko, but that was just such a rich part of this episode. We had to really hash it out a little bit. Let's talk about King Bumi, because this was obviously this was the big King Bumi episode, which is it's really, really fun and interesting. And, you know, Alec, you want to talk a little bit about, you know, kind of briefly, just some of the way the different cultures are. We're really starting to see a distinction between different cultures in this show, and you had some notes about that, I believe.
I do. Sorry, I've got about 16 sheets in front of me right now. So here we go. Okay, so with this one, I was curious, you know, looking back at the animated show, what these kingdoms are based on. You know, the air nomads are obviously Tibetan monks. It's very obvious. The water tribe is indigenous Arctic tribes. Earth was China, and Fire Nation is Japan, based on the sitar, based on the koto being played with the Fire Nation, and some of the rituals, them wearing white at the funeral with no jewelry. I think we can safely say that the Fire Nation is still supposed to be Japan.
Interesting.
I think so.
All different Asian cultures, all four nations.
Yes. Yep. And so this is interesting from a sense that The animated show was did not involve India at all, as far as I know, and here we are in the live action, and they've changed the Earth Kingdom from Chinese to India, which one allows for, I think, maybe a richer look at all of Asia. Obviously, India and China are two of the largest nations of the world, the two largest nations of the world as far as population is concerned. So I think, you know, maybe from a director standpoint or a producer standpoint, you know, or Netflix just in general, this kind of opens up maybe more of an audience for them worldwide. But I really like the changes. I mean, yeah. Bumi's hat is like, is the first thing you see. You know, the first time you realize it is when you get the flashback. And you hear the sitar, I don't know the child actor's name who played young Boomy, but you know, you immediately get a sense of like, hang on, this isn't Chinese. So
yes.
You know, and then Boomy rolling on his throne with the round rock.
Yeah.
And just that whole scene of the kind of jade green statues of Flopsy and him rolling in. So, you know, the culture we get to see here, I think this is a good choice from the producers. It allows them to bring in different actors and actresses, you know, from India. I don't know. It just makes it more rich, I think.
I think so, too.
I agree with you because they're doing an interesting thing here of kind of making the Earth Kingdom very, very rich. Like, it is a continent. Like, we have a lot of different cultures. When we first arrive at Kyoshi Island, like, they're even very different.
Yeah.
I think in the show, isn't the Earth Kingdom the largest kingdom, right?
It is.
Yeah, it is.
By a pretty large margin, actually. Yeah, and the actor, too. Let's talk about King Boomy a little bit. I mean, the actor has been in lots of different stuff. He was in Free Guy, if you remember. He played
Free Guy, Pitch Perfect.
CEO. Yeah, Pitch Perfect. he was on Critical Role for a little bit. So like, we've seen him around, you know, in lots of different things. And I think the internet is pretty mixed on the depiction of Boomy, is what it seems like. And I think one of the biggest, most controversial changes in this show is kind of King Boomy's anger and his sort of attitude about, you know, the plot device by which Boomy helps Aang is very different. Where in the animated show, he's this supportive. He teaches him a lesson about, you know, relying on his friends. And he kind of has a similar lesson in this show, but his attitude is completely different, right? He's very, he's angry. He's bitter. He's mad that Aang has kind of skipped the war and abandoned the world, if you will, a little bit. What do you guys think about that portrayal? Does that add depth to Boomy? Is that a more interesting story? How did you feel about the change, Caitlin?
I don't know how I feel about it. Like, I think it made me very confused because I'm so used to Aang seeing people from his past and they're giving enlightenment to him. So, like, they're teaching him something. And while Boomy's still trying to teach him something in this show, like, we actually find out that Aang teaches Boomy.
Yeah.
So, like, the roles are reversed. And I don't hate it, but it's very, I guess, shocking to me. Like, it's very new.
I think it makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one thing we keep saying, and it's very true, is that this show, it doesn't hide away from things. It's a way more adult version of the show.
Yeah.
And the sense of character development, you know, along of some of the graphic things that you get to see. But yeah, I mean, you know, this makes sense to me. Boomy has been around for 100 years, and mm-hmm. he tells Aang, you know, you may be 100 years old, but you haven't lived 100 years. And that
was a great line.
I think that line, you know, perfectly sums up where the two of them are. Boomy, you know, had a friend. Now, I don't know if Boomy knew that he was the Avatar at the time. I guess he did.
I don't know. That was also confusing to me.
What, this in the live action show or the animated show?
The live action.
Child.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Did he know? I mean, maybe. He sure did know in this show because he named it, like, very immediately.
I'm assuming that, and, you know, maybe assuming is the wrong way to go about it, but I'm assuming that part of the reason that Aang was traveling around into the Earth Kingdom and into the Fire Nation, into the Water Nation, is to establish those connections as he was trying to learn to become the Avatar. Yeah. So,
that's a good point.
But yeah, so I think Boomy being resentful and angry makes sense.
Yeah,
he's still a little crazy.
He is a little crazy. They got that. I think they got that spot on. You know, the first time I watched it, I was not nearly as convinced. The second time I watched it, I was like, wow, this really is Boomy. Like the actor clearly studied and watched and got the grunting and the walking and the hunched over and the stutter and the snort. Like, it's very accurate to the original character, I thought. The makeup bothered me a little bit. I think the first time I watched it, I literally didn't care about it at all. The second time, I was like, all right, this is Boomy. I'm in.
Yeah.
That was really fun. And I agree with you guys. I think I like the sort of attitude shift. It's like, now you know, he's mad and
he's very resentful.
It's like all this weight is on your shoulders. I need you to understand this. And I think Aang ultimately learns that lesson. And I kind of like the confidence here. Like,
yeah,
you know, that's been one of the kind of criticisms of the animated show is Aang was just kind of an annoying kid the whole first season, right?
Yeah.
In this show, we're like kind of quickly getting to the
he's understanding responsibility.
I think. I think, you know, from a psychology standpoint here, and you feel free to correct me, but this is a scene to me that is showing, you know, Bumi gets most angry when Aang is trying to call him on his shit, basically.
Yeah.
When Aang's like, hey, you've given up and this isn't you. And Bumi's like, well, you haven't been here. What do you mean I've given up? But the reality is that Omashu's not in the war and they haven't been.
Yeah.
You know, for all intents and purposes, Bumi hasn't given up on his people, but he's given up on the war and he's not involved right now. So, and Aang calls him on that and that makes him very, very angry. And
that's initially what happens when you call people out is they become very, very defensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not usually like, oh my gosh, you're right. Wow. I didn't think about that. That never happens.
Yeah, no,
that's true. I think, the last couple of things I want to kind of mention about Bumi is I just want to shout out a couple of the Easter eggs a little bit here because we have several moments from the animated show. I love the Flopsy inclusion. Yeah, the Flopsy statues.
They were beautiful. I kind of want one for my house.
It was a little funny that there were so many statues. I think
four.
No, dude, there's like 10.
No.
There are so many. Like I said, the room that they're in is the Flopsy room. Like if it had a name, this is the Flopsy room because like there's like 10 statues. They're all over the place. They're like, hey, just so all of the viewers know, make sure you know, here it is, the Flopsy's in the episode. Did you miss it? Because it's in this scene, in this scene, in this scene. It's in all these different shots. So that was kind of funny, Flopsy being there. The rock candy was in the episode, right? That was a key part of the original show.
I didn't understand that scene very well.
Me either. It felt like it was a little forced in there.
What do you say, like the straight path is not always the best path or something?
Yeah, like the lesson was very good.
I guess.
But I don't understand. I don't understand it.
My notes say the best path is not always the best path, and I don't think that's what he said.
The straight path isn't always the best path, or like the direct path isn't always the best.
I think the most important thing from that scene is Bumi saying there's no easy journeys for the Avatar.
Yeah, I get it, but he's also just walking down a hallway and he steps on rocks. So, it's
that's fair. Fair enough.
It was one of those kind of fan service.
It was a stretch. It was a stretch.
Yeah,
it's
passive aggressiveness from Bumi.
A little bit.
Because Aang's like, WTF, man. Like, why did you do that? And he's like, maybe I just wanted some candy.
It's like, okay. I mean, yeah, that was kind of funny.
You can't tell me that a guard has never stopped, like, stepped on that same spot.
Yeah, it's just in this hallway. It's just like, you're going to step on it. Anyway, so that was kind of funny. We got the lettuce leaf line. When they're at the, Caitlin and I say that, like, every week, I think, genuinely, whenever we're going to leave somewhere, we're like, all right, lettuce leaf. We say that, truly, all the time. It's so funny that we got that. I knew he was going to say, as soon as you start flopping around that piece of lettuce in that scene.
He held on to it for a while. Yeah, that was so reminiscent to me of the cabbages scene where they kept like throwing it at you but not saying the line, saying the line, and then he's just holding that lettuce leaf for like a good solid minute before hitting.
There was a cabbage scene in this episode.
There was
very like subtle
at the very end. Did you catch that, Alec?
Yes, of course.
They smash into the cabbage at the very end, and you hear the guy. It doesn't show him again, but you hear him. He's like, my cabbages. There was another. I don't know if you guys noticed this. There was a second lettuce joke in his lettuce leaf. Mm-hmm. He said the word. He said the word iceberg, and when he said the word iceberg, he was like really flopping it aggressively.
Oh,
I did not get that.
My brain went straight to iceberg. Oh. Lettuce. I don't know if that was intentional, but it was definitely.
He was holding a romaine lettuce.
I know it didn't make any sense, but I was like, "There's no way this is an accident." Iceberg. Anyway, all right.
That is good.
I think that is the. That's my main gist about King Bumi.
Yeah, I think Bumi having a fight club is interesting. It's obvious that is like a place for them to spar, almost like a coliseum of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, for entertainment. I don't know how many people it actually holds, but
I don't know.
If it's located underneath the castle, I would assume that it's kind of an exclusive style fight club that Bumi holds down there.
I guess so. Though you can't talk.
It reminded me of the arena that Toph we get introduced to.
Yeah.
Toph.
does kind of look like that.
When
did you notice he had? Did you notice his armpit hair?
Yes.
Yes. How could you not, bro?
He had so bushy armpit hair. Sure,
they had to glue that in.
That was great.
Yeah. Yeah, the when he like takes off his robes and he's wearing this like WWE style Earth Kingdom belt.
That was funny. Yeah, good stuff. Yeah. Good stuff.
I think that was actually one of my favorite scenes is when he like tries to get Aang to kill him. Was like, you have a choice to make and you have to make sacrifices. Which one do you want to make for yourself
or
for others?
Yeah, the first
interesting depiction of the lesson, I think, different but still not bad. I think it worked.
The first couple times I watched it, I didn't like. I heard the line about, you know, or are you going to save this town or that town?
Yeah.
And then when I watched it for like the third time, I heard like the, you know, he's not talking about just like this town or that. He's talking about like, are you going to save like this orphanage? Are you going to feed these people? Or are you going to feed those people? And it's like, oh my gosh, like, Bumi has had to make some impossible choices, but like some like.
It
like
was
life decisions.
That, because like he said, do you feed the soldiers or the orphans? And so do you feed the soldiers that are protecting your people or do you feed your people? Which one do you choose? These are very hard decisions.
I like that. Well, I like that note too, because it seems like in a lot of animated shows, especially kids shows, you don't really get true depictions of what the war is.
This is real life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it happens a couple times. It happens with the Earth Kingdom soldier in Iroh too, right? Where he says that, you know, he talks about the rationing on the walls and all that kind of stuff too, right? And, you know, it seems like there's too much exposition in the animated show about the war. It doesn't really talk about the war very much. Like, so getting these sort of small moments that kind of tell what the world has been like is really good, I think. There's no real sense of that in the animated show. Not really. That the war has been really bad, you know? Like, there's no real sense of that, I think. Now, the next thing I want to talk about a little bit is talking about, you know, the secret tunnel and Sokka and Katara's story a little bit. But before we do that, we do have to hear from this week's sponsor, the United Patreon community. We will be right back. Hello, friends. We're taking a short break from the show to talk to you about our vibrant Patreon and Discord community, which we call The United. The United is the heart of the Uteniverse, where fans of Star Wars, nerd culture, and even sports unite. It's all about diving deep into the fandoms we love with a spirit of passion and positivity alongside other fans who share those same values. Now on Patreon, you'll find an exclusive world of content. From behind-the-scenes peeks at our YouTube channel productions to ad-free versions of all of our podcasts alongside other insider updates. It's really your all-access pass to what goes on behind the curtain and on the team at Uteni. But the United is more than just content. It's a community. With features designed to bring us closer, we're building a space where every fan has a voice. As we look to the future, your feedback and involvement will shape the direction of the United. So this is really your chance to be part of a community that's at the heart of our mission, fostering a sense of belonging that's essential for every fan. If you're ready to join the United, head over to our site, uteni.com, to find our Discord, or to patreon.com/uteni to jump into Patreon. Let's make this community stronger together and dive into a world where your passion for fandom becomes a shared adventure. Now, let's get back to the show. Hello, friends. We're taking a short break from the show to talk to you about our vibrant Patreon and Discord community, which we call The United. The United is the heart of the Uteniverse, where fans of Star Wars, nerd culture, and even sports unite. It's all about diving deep into the fandoms we love with a spirit of passion and positivity alongside other fans who share those same values. Now on Patreon, you'll find an exclusive world of content. From behind-the-scenes peeks at our YouTube channel productions to ad-free versions of all of our podcasts alongside other insider updates. It's really your all-access pass to what goes on behind the curtain and on the team at Uteni. But the United is more than just content. It's a community. With features designed to bring us closer, we're building a space where every fan has a voice. As we look to the future, your feedback and involvement will shape the direction of the United. So this is really your chance to be part of a community that's at the heart of our mission, fostering a sense of belonging that's essential for every fan. If you're ready to join the United, head over to our site, uteni.com, to find our Discord, or to patreon.com/uteni to jump into Patreon. Let's make this community stronger together and dive into a world where your passion for fandom becomes a shared adventure. Now, let's get back to the show. All right, folks, welcome back. Let's continue our conversation all about Avatar: The Last Airbender. And I do want to talk about the other episode that was kind of squeezed into this episode, which was the Secret Tunnel episode. You know, that was actually in season two. So that's kind of interesting to see, you know, something from season two brought in. This was definitely different than the animated show, right? This was also one of the other pieces that it seemed like the internet is a little bit torn about, of like, some people loved it, some people hated it. I think we can all agree that it was different, and there's a lot to love and maybe some things to not be as crazy about. So, you know, I think the main difference here is that the Tunnel of Love in the show was, you know, a sort of launching off point for a bit of the romance between Aang and Katara. And in this show, it was very different. You know,
kind of love.
Yeah, it's the brotherly sister love, Sokka and Katara. What were your sort of gut reaction to that change, Kate?
Okay, so the first time I watched it, I was very mad. I was very mad because the secret tunnel is something that I've been joking about for years and, like, has been one of my favorite, like, off-the-cuff scenes in the whole series. But the second time I watched it, I think I appreciated it a lot more. And I understand the depth to it. Like, they did it well.
Yeah.
They did it well. It was just very different than what I was expecting.
Alec, what about you?
Yeah, look, the scene's good. I love the casting what is his name? I don't remember, and I'm not going to remember. But the main guitarist, vocalist,
musician
for...
That dude was hilarious.
He was great. He did such a good job. I liked it. I don't mind them changing it from how they originally met. I do kind of miss the, like, they all go through the tunnel together and they get split and the, you know, I think this is the one scene in the show that if I have critiques, this is where it lands. Mm-hmm. And just on a surface level, like, I'll just get out of the way. But it's really two things. One, I don't like that Sokka and Katara are the ones in there. I understand the sibling love, but I just feel a little weird about it, just to be honest. Yeah. And then I don't love that the badger moles respond to love. That doesn't make sense to me.
We can all agree, regardless what you think of the badger moles. That was very confusing, and I watched it twice, and I still don't really understand. Like, in the animated show, it's like they sense the vibration, which is why they respond to the music, right? They're blind. Yeah. That makes
all
sense.
Four
earthbenders, like Toph, senses it with her feet too. Like, it's well established that the sound.
I'll foreshadow a flying cow right there. You know, it's like it's I don't know. I much prefer the animated show's thing of Sokka having like an instrument.
Yes.
And he falls on it, and they respond to the music, and the music is what gets them through. And I don't think it would have been that big of a stretch for, like, the guy to say to Sokka, like, oh, dude, you know, you play that maraca really well. Like, you should keep it.
Yeah,
he makes him take it, and he, like, drops it or something.
And then like Sokka has to play the maracas to, like, get the. I think that would have been, like, a more fun way of doing it.
Yes.
You know, that would have stuck to the original. This whole, like, sibling love is what they respond. I don't get that, man. I really don't. But going back to the good parts of the scene, you know, the Tale of Two Lovers, I love that they kept the artistic styling of that. I love that they changed it to both of them being women.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I was in there. Listener, if you didn't notice that, they are both definitely women. And I went back and looked at the pronouns and the way they talked about it, too. And it is definitely, they're both women. That was really cool. Oma and Shu, like, I was a big fan of that. That was awesome. That whole animated style was fantastic. The art on the wall, the narration, that was 10 out of 10. One of my favorite parts, honestly, of the whole episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I'll push back, I guess, a little bit on both you guys with the sort of brother, sister, sibling thing, because one of the critiques I saw online that I actually totally agree with is the sort of harsh reality here is that in the animated show, Aang is 12 and Katara is 14. So,
only 2 years.
It is only 2 years, but they're kids, truly kids. And, like, getting a real true romance, like, at this current age between live action characters probably would have been very weird.
Oh,
like,
that's probably true.
Like, I don't know that I can see.
That's very true.
You know, I don't know, like, if I can see it. You know, you get a lot of kind of pass for that sort of stuff in animation, anime especially, like, but, like,
I mean,
that would have been awkward.
Young kids have young love. Yeah.
Are we gonna put a kiss scene between these two actors? Like that weirds me out. I don't like that. That
not
seems weird.
They want to? Right. I don't want to force it.
It seems.
I think. I think at some point, you know, like season three, mm-hmm. They'll end up having like a Mei and Zuko kiss scene or something, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well, my question is, are they? I just had this thought when y'all were like, it changed. Are we getting rid of Katara and Aang? Because maybe. They seem to be very friendly and there doesn't seem to be any romance. In which sure. case, do we get to ship Katara and Zuko? Maybe. Which I would be super excited about.
I don't know. It's a good question. We're not getting a ton of moments between Aang and Katara.
I
want to point out the fact that we are in episode 4 and Aang has not done any waterbending whatsoever. Can we talk about that? That's pretty crazy. But
the only waterbending he did is when he splashed, when he reached down into the water to splash Katara.
That's right. Yeah.
And neither of them did any waterbending. It was weird. That scene still to me is so weird that instead of either of them doing waterbending to play with each other, they both reached down to the water like you or I would have to do.
I know.
Yeah.
Splash each other.
That was pretty funny. That's
we got to talk about the minstrels.
Yeah.
We do have musicians. To talk about that.
Musicians are really fun. There's a whole song. He sings the whole song. There are lyrics. Those lyrics are different from the animated show, I want to point out. They're completely different. They have different theme and everything. Like, there's a well-thought-out whole song, actually, in the live-action show, which is pretty interesting.
I think they just cut it.
Huh?
I think they just cut it. Like, there's a full elaborate song in the animation, but they didn't sing the whole version of this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I read that there's some structure to the song and everything, mm-hmm. which is kind of different. They also use the secret tunnel to get to the Earth, like get inside the palace, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of different. Doesn't quite make as much sense, I don't think, as the animated show.
That is very much a, like, from a writer perspective of like, okay, we have to figure out a way to get his friends into the fight club
how do we get them there? They're just in the fight club. Like,
I have no idea. Sokka's like, Sokka's like, oh, you respond to love. Well, do you respond to speech?
Yeah,
take us there.
That made no sense. 100% agree.
Corey,
the Badger Mall taxis.
I do want to ask you. What did you think of the sibling portrayal? Because you have sisters. I have a sister, but that's like female to female. And then, Alec, do you have any siblings?
I have nothing.
Okay. So, like, what was it? Do you feel like it was accurate as the brother and sister relationship?
Yeah, I do think it was pretty accurate. I mean, I think there's a couple small moments that develop, like, Sokka and Katara really well through that. There's the first time where they had the big fight, and, like, mm-hmm. and Katara's like, well, you're not dad. And that really affects, you know, Sokka, and then they immediately sit down and work out their differences. I mean, they seem pretty realistic. There was a part where I think you pointed it out when you were watching it, Caitlin, where they were like kind of complimenting each other and then immediately turned and were like really mean to each other. I'm like, that's siblings 100%. I mean, they said it was something like, I don't remember what they were talking about. It was something like, you know, he said I was an engineer or something or reading the map and then like something happened and they're like, I told you were wrong about this or something. Like that's exactly how it is.
Aggression
and
and
ultimately coming to the lesson that yes, we do truly love each other and we're here for each other, and that's what siblings are. Only in death.
But you can also just you know the one thing that's going to piss them off the most, and you just you have no problem throwing it in their face, and when she says like, you're not dad,
that's
the moment, right?
I know.
Where she's like, oh, you want to go? Dagger to heart immediately. Boom, turn it.
He did it back to her by saying, if you don't want to be treated like a kid, stop acting like it.
Yeah.
And that's when she throws it back at him.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because he's basically saying, you are a child.
There's a few other small moments in the show I really want to hit before we kind of finish up here. And, you know, let's briefly talk about the dynamic between the Earthbender soldier and Iroh. That was a great inclusion part of this whole episode.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really graphic depiction of description, rather, of violence. You know, the soldier calls Iroh a butcher, which is a really harsh language to use.
Fabulous line.
He also says the line, he's talking about his brother, and he says, when you torched the East Wall, like the language that they chose to use to kind of describe the Dragon of the West is pretty harsh and violent language, which I think we really never saw much of this. Like, and again, we keep going back to this. This live action show is not afraid to steer us in the direction of the last 100 years have been hell, right? And violent and brutal.
Yeah.
And, you know, there, Iroh has consequences to face, right? He has this past to reckon with a little bit. What do you guys think about this whole Earthbender soldier scene? Kind of how this depiction of Iroh, how does that affect your sort of understanding of the Iroh of this show rather than the sort of soft grandfather figure of Iroh in the animated show?
Mm-hmm.
I guess when I'm looking at this, I'm thinking about Iroh's complexity. He is, you know, he's not infallible. You know, obviously he has a very wise side of him. You know, he does have a lot of compassion. You know, I'm not sure at what point in his life he learned these lessons. You know, he is the brother of the new Fire Lord, so there is, you know, some royal responsibilities. But when you're the second son, you know, you always know that your life is basically meant to be in the shadows. So I think there is a level of pressure from royalty that's kind of lifted off of his shoulders as he's gone about his life. So, you know, when we kind of see him in these scenes, and we've seen one in the first episode and a couple different takes, especially in the scenes where he's with Aang, where it's like, Aang's like, why are you guys doing this? Why are you fighting? And he's like, well, my brother sees only, you know, two things, victory or defeat, mm-hmm. you know, and I was kind of given the company line a couple of times, and he's explained it away of like, you know, we're at war, and this is, you know, it is what it is kind of a thing. And, you know, the Earth Kingdom soldier asked him, like, was it worth it? Was all of the, you know, the death and the torture and the, you know, killing my brother and, you know, starving everybody and laying siege, was it worth it? And he's like, we were at war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He says, war pushes us to the edge, is what Iroh said, which
yeah.
It was this really strong line. You know, I think we're really seeing, we're looking into eyes of regret when we look at Iroh in a lot yeah. of ways. And, you know, I love that the show is not afraid to steer us around that. We've seen several depictions of violence and war. And yeah.
I think we see that level of calmness, you know, especially, you know, with soldiers. You know, if you ever see a documentary with SEALs talking about the things that they go through or mm-hmm. things like that, when people who have been pushed and continue to push themselves to the edge, you know, they have a level of like calm demeanor that almost doesn't make sense. You know, it's yeah. like you like know what they've been through and they talk about it, but they do it in such a casual way.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a sign that they have come to an understanding and an acceptance.
Yeah.
And they know what they did. They know what they had to do. And, you know, the only way that they can live now is by, you know, accepting that it happened for what it is and trying to continue on with the rest of their lives. Otherwise, they'll just be stuck in this, you know, this level of reflection that is very negative.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we get to see that with Iroh. And whether or not, you know, as a character, you know, that resonates with people, I'm not sure. But, you know, I can definitely see it.
Yeah. I totally agree. Big fan of the description of war, I think, in this show. I'm a big fan of, I guess the last thing I want to kind of hit, there were two small scenes.
Can I add something to
yeah,
that?
Go ahead.
I think that scene between Iroh and the soldier was very powerful because it's mirror images of each other. There's a duality between loss and grief of both sides of war. You see Iroh saying, I was a soldier, and you see the duality of that guy saying, no, you were a butcher, because he was both. He was both. And to the same effects, Iroh could also see the Earth Kingdom soldiers as butchers to his son. Mm-hmm. That's what really happened when he said that, like, striking line. Corey, I don't remember what it was, but he says something, and then he says, I wasn't talking about me.
Call an ambulance, but not for me.
Yeah, yeah, basically. Basically.
Yeah.
He says, war pushes us to the edge. Some of us don't like what we find there.
Yeah. And, like, we think it's about Iroh, yeah. but...
Yes, and then he says, is that your pitiful way of saying sorry?
Yeah. And what he's saying here is that even the good guy, there is no good guy in war.
Yeah.
There really isn't.
Yeah. It's a important reflection that I think we're really supposed to have when we watch this show. And, you know, I keep harping on it. I love that this is a big change in the animated show. I'm just a big fan of this entire, you know, reflection about a 100-year war is a good change to make. That I wasn't...
100-year war, you got to realize that's at least 3 to 4 generations.
That's crazy.
Of people.
Yeah.
Unless you're Boomy.
Yeah. In which case, you've lived through it all.
<That's true. laughs> I think that is just about all the time we really have to talk about this episode. There were so many other small moments we didn't really even get a chance to touch on. The fact that Jet was kind of in this episode for a moment, we had to conclude that subplot. The Mechanist was in this episode, and we got to conclude that one as well. But this was overall a fun episode. You know, I think this is one of the lower rated ones on IMDb, which I think the first time I saw it, I kind of felt similarly, I think, about it. But on second rewatch and after talking about it, I definitely feel much happier, I guess, about this episode. There was a lot of rich storytelling, I think, in this one. And It was kind of contrasted with some of the goofier stuff I think we've seen so far, which is probably why it's rated a little lower. But I don't care. Before we get out of here, we do have to hit a couple of our traditions in the episode. Let's really quickly go through these because we are almost out of time here. Let's talk about flying cows really briefly. Alec, you kind of already alluded to yours. Is it the badger moles?
Yeah, I'm going to take the badger moles on this one. We've talked about it enough, so I won't harp on it again, but it's still a weird plot line, and it feels very much like the writers just said, oh, crap, we need to get from A to B.
Yeah, 100%. I think my flying cow is actually really, really short and really goofy. I realized this in the episode. When Zuko like attacks that guy in the back to steal his clothes, he like grabs him and pulls him into the bush, and then the camera shows the helmet like rolling on the ground, and then before the helmet even stops rolling, Zuko steps out of the bush fully clothed in earthbending clothes, and he picks up the helmet before it even stops moving. I'm like, wow, he sure did change really fast. It was really funny.
Never be the last guy in line. That's all I'd say.
That's right.
Also, that guy must not matter because nobody on patrol realized he was gone.
Yes, at all. It was a plot device. One of those things like getting from point A to point B that you ask any questions. Yeah. I know. Caitlin, do you have a quick one?
Corey, we mentioned it the second time we watched it, and my flying cow is that weird hand-holding thing at the funeral. Zuko gives him the medal, and Iroh just has his palm out, and then Zuko closes his hand around it. That this has happened a lot in this show, but like it doesn't seem natural.
It is really unnatural.
When you put something in my hand, I naturally close my fist. Like I don't need you to close it for me.
They do that in a lot of movies.
It's emotional,
show, right?
Like I see it. It's
when you're giving somebody something, you like they close their fingers around.
It's like that second act of like longer physical touch that creates a moment, right?
It was just really goofy. Caitlin and I like paused the show and we tested it. We're like, this feels so awkward. Like
I don't think I've ever thought about that, to be honest with you.
It looked weird.
But like you see it in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, now, you're gonna see it. We've seen it in the show like 4 times. I don't know why they keep doing this. It's really goofy and funny. All right, Sokka Snacks. Do you have a favorite moment? Just a goofy, random, fun, anything that kind of stood out to you? That was like, oh yeah, this is my jam. Anything that stand out?
I mean, I think you know, you kind of spoke on it briefly, but the Jet Katara scene where. You know, Jet shows up randomly in the middle of the night, not weird at all. And and she's he says like, look at the power that I gave you, and she's like, that's not you, that's me.
Oh yeah.
And I thought that was a great moment. You know, Jet is a great character, but he's really just a character to help propel Katara's growth. Mm-hmm. So
Kate, you have a Sokka snack?
Corey, I want to know yours first because I have two and you might steal one of mine.
My Sokka snack was the scene, the emotional, violent scene between Iroh and the Earth Kingdom, the Earth Kingdom soldier. I just thought that was really rich. I loved the harsh language and kind of the thoughts about war, how the guy almost loses control and kills him. It was just really, really good. You know, the scene that immediately follows, too, the choreography, that fight scene, too, was awesome. With Iroh with the chain, the fire scene was dope. I mean, that was really, really fun. So that was probably my Sokka snack.
Yeah.
Okay, then I still have two.
All right.
One, Zuko sitting with Iroh, like, choosing to sit and, like, with him in his grief at the funeral. That was just really powerful, and I loved that, and it was totally my vibe. My second one is actually Katara and Sokka in the cave. When she says, you're not like dad, or you're not dad, she later comes back and says, you had it much harder than dad.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that like just struck me as such a powerful moment, especially for a young male to hear that you had it harder than your father is just really powerful. And I think it got like pushed over really fast.
Yeah, it's a good moment. Good shout out. Mm-hmm. What about MVPs for this episode? Who do you think the MVP of this episode was? Got one right up here.
I got one.
Go ahead.
Mine was the Earth Kingdom soldier. I think he's just my MVP. His grief and anger, and he just played his part perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'll be a little more cliche, and I will say it was Zuko. I think Zuko's depiction in the show is fantastic. I loved the really emotional moment. I mean, the actor really nailed it. I really felt like I was there, like with the sitting down beside Iroh and the funeral. It was just really, really good. He's my MVP.
I'll give it to the actor who played Boomy. I think that is it, that is such a difficult character to play. I was like trying to think like, okay, if I was going to, how would I even attempt to make this? And I think the reality is that's a character that's so difficult to play that no matter what you do, I think you are going to be villainized for something. You know, obviously it's a good role to get as an actor. But it challenges you a lot. And I hope the actor had fun playing it. I really enjoyed seeing his adaptation. I think everybody who watched it, probably the first time they watched it, was a little off put by one thing or another. But I think that's more just a reflection of how difficult the character is. So
yeah.
I want to give it to him, and you know, just kind of harp on how hard that must have been, but how well he did. And you know, having watched it a couple times, it doesn't bother me at all, and I think he did an exceptional job.
I totally agree. Like I said, he kind of rubbed me funny the first time I saw it, but after I got used to him, I'm like, all right, I'm in. This is Boomy. This is live action. It's one of those things, just like animation to live action is so hard.
It is hard.
Like, I just don't, it's rare that they get it perfect, and, you know, Boomy was tough act to film, I would say. But
yep.
That's going to do it for this week's episode of Avatar, the Utini Avatar Show. If you are looking for other shows, be sure to check out the rest of our lineup in the Utini Network. I want to have a special thank you to some of our patrons, Brian Dooley, Carl Sandel, Michael Fry, and Raymond Bozinski on our High Council, and James T., Ashley Ingalls, Colton Five, and Chris Carrizo on our Captain tier. Thank you so much for your amazing support. We will keep the party going over in Discord. We have a special channel, Avatar Netflix. You can find out and hang out with us. We can chat about the show a little bit. Huge shout out to our behind the scenes folks, Kyle, for making us sound good, my fellow host for juggling all the things, and Wes for your Utini Network to support. All right, that's going to be it. Keep exploring, keep sharing. Let's keep hanging out in the Avatar universe together. We'll catch you next week. Support for this show and all Utini Network podcasts comes from the United Patreon community. At the heart of the Utiniverse, the United is where our most passionate fans gather to deepen their journey through the worlds of Avatar, Star Wars, and the broader universe of nerd culture and sports. By joining the United on Patreon, you gain access to an exclusive realm filled with content that takes you behind the scenes of our YouTube channel, provides ad-free listening of all of our podcasts, and offers regular insider updates. More than just a content hub, the United is a vibrant community. Through organized events, we create connections, fostering a space where every voice is heard and valued. By becoming part of the United, you're not just supporting us, you're enhancing a community dedicated to celebrating and exploring our passions together. To start your journey, visit patreon.com/utini. Together, we can build a stronger community, united by our love for these incredible fandoms. Thank you for your support, and remember, the adventure continues in every episode of The Avatar Show and across all Utini Network podcasts.